Hello. Just to let you know that this episode contains strong language.
Ooh. It's Saturday, the 4th of September. I've had a month off from recording, which has been really nice. And I'm in my garden in Camborne. And it's my birthday today. I am 27. No, 28. I'm 28 years old today. And it's that funny bit of time before the party when you've got everything set up and all the food's laid out, but no one's turned up yet. And you wonder if they ever will. And then, of course, suddenly they all turn up at the same time. You eat something, you have a little sing-song, and then before you know it, 8 hours have passed and it's time for everyone to go home. But the reason why I'm recording this is because two funny things have just happened in quick succession. Firstly, and this isn't meant to be a brag, but my show Pagan Pandemonium was given a certificate of recognition for its contribution towards Cornish culture last night. It was from the Gorsef Curnow. Do you remember them? The bards who dress up in blue robes? I spoke to the Grand Bard in episode 5, I think. Anyway, I wasn't able to attend the ceremony last night in person, but I am still delighted to be sent a certificate in the post. Coincidentally, this morning, the Pagan Pandemonium video on YouTube received a new comment. Maybe someone had checked it out after the ceremony, I thought. But who do you think it was? Our old friend, Dick Penberthy, my very own Cornish troll. Dick's comment said, very English culture, with some superficial Cornish culture sparsely interspersed within it. Why does this get Cornish money when genuine Cornish culture doesn't? When I saw this, I just thought, oh God, here we go again. Firstly, what is Cornish money? Because the majority of that project was funded by Arts Council England. Secondly, can someone please define genuine Cornish culture for me? And thirdly, fuck off. This once again got me thinking about Cornish culture, what it means to be part of this place, and whether I actually want to be part of it. Throughout this podcast series, I've tried my hardest to see things from both sides of the argument. A lot of the issues facing Cornwall today are nuanced, with no simple answer, and require a certain amount of empathy. But if I'm honest, there have been times and certain people who have put me off the idea altogether. I found myself thinking, you know what? Be that way. I'll take my energy somewhere else, where I feel more welcome. But then I think, no. I need to override this grumpy minority with as much exciting, challenging, and positive work as I can. But with that comes a load of other questions. If I'm to stay in this place, can I actually sustain myself by solely making work here? How do you remain a truly local person whilst being outward-looking at the same time? And is this actually the place where I want to live? Let's find out in The Reason Why.
Episode 10, Truly Local.
Over the past year, I've started thinking more and more about where I want to live in the future, whether I'll ever buy a house, and ultimately, where I'd like to start a family. As much as I'm aware of the problems facing Cornwall, I feel quite positive and passionate about the challenge of trying to live and work here. On this subject, I want to tell you the story of one infamous group of artists who were very much shaped by where they were from, had big aspirations, and ended up on the world stage.
It also recognises that sometimes people can get left behind. Not only do I have a personal connection to this story, but it acts as a metaphor for one of the central dilemmas that has come up time and time again in this series. To begin, I need to introduce you to my dad, Jim. You can probably tell he's originally from Scotland.
Okay, so I've lived here actually for, would you believe, almost 40 years, which is actually works out as being two-thirds of my life.
In some ways, my dad and I are very similar. He spent most of his life being a composer and performer. A lot of what I do was learnt through osmosis, growing up exposed to the world of music and theatre in Cornwall. Jim originally came here on a bit of a whim during the early 80s.
When you moved down, did you think that you were going to spend the rest of your life
here? I didn't think that at first, but then I got married quite young and had kids quite early, and also, so we got in quite passionate about making theatre, and I ended up, so the theatre company was obviously the probably biggest, well, it was the most successful and the biggest theatre company in Cornwall, and so that was exciting and it was new and it took over, and at first I thought, yeah, I'll go back to Scotland, I want to go back to Scotland at some point, and then that kind of, you know, filtered out a bit because I was being creative.
The theatre company that he's talking about is Knee High. Jim rocked up with his two mates, Tim and Dave, who as a trio had been busking around Europe together. They'd heard about some bloke called Mike who was setting up a company, and they thought they'd see what was going on. Little did they know, it would end up being a hugely influential and pivotal moment in their careers and personal lives. Now, I know what some of you might be thinking. Why is Seamus telling us about some regional theatre company? I've never even heard of them and it can't be that important. But I think there's an interesting point here about the social impact a company can have on a small rural place. To prove a point, someone once told me a story about how an elderly Cornish couple were asked if they go see theatre much. Their answer was, nope. Then they were asked if they ever went to see Knee High. The couple's answer was, oh yeah, we go see Knee High. The fact that they saw a difference for me says it all. But what was different?
Knee High's first show, Awful Can Awful, I got arrested partway through the performance by PC Burstow.
There literally wasn't a child in Cornwall that didn't know who Knee High were. They went into schools, and so that was a whole generation that understood theatre that was like that.
It was capturing something about the elemental part of Cornwall in the work, which was very different, and it felt, to Cornish people, it felt very deep, I think.
You definitely had an audience who weren't what you would call classic theatre-going audiences, because the Hall for Cornwall didn't exist then. We just went anywhere.
Yeah, Knee High Theatre was all about playing and having fun and making things up.
Founded in 1980 by Mike Shepherd and a ragtag bunch of mates, Knee High began performing outdoor stunts and children's shows in schools and village halls. I think it would be fair to say that they were very much making it up as they went along, taking risks and experimenting with no pressure from Arts Council quotas or audience expectations. But as Jim told me, soon they found their voice.
Subject matter and the humour and everything was quite socialist in a way. Most of it was about the social cement thing. I think, well, I can only speak for myself, but I think we felt that we were saying something about society.
For a long time, Knee High consisted of a fairly small, regular pool of local performers. However, slowly, other artists began to join and bring new influences, such as the power couple, Bill Mitchell and Sue Hill. Here's Sue.
It was anarchic more than socialist, I think. There was very little structure. But in a way, that was the freedom of it. We didn't have a whole load of boxes to tick or goals to achieve or, you know, schedules to complete. We were making stuff and being totally absorbed in making it. We really felt like we were fellow travellers who'd found each other. You know, we'd found our tribe at that point.
I think there's a lot to be said here for the circumstances in which Knee-High made its work. There was barely any money, and they lived in a rural, inaccessible place. By the early 90s, the company had made an old barn in the sleepy village of Gorenhaven their permanent home. Sue explained more.
I can't imagine that it would have grown up in a city. There's something about the fact that we had the barns at Goran, which are impossible to get to. You know, you lived, ate, worked, sometimes slept with the people you were working with, and it meant that you had this incredibly rich time, because there was no, in a sense, you might go to the pub, but there were always, even in the pub, you'd be diddling away with a bit of music, or nobody went home and switched off.
So it does sound a bit commune-y, but they were prolific too. The 90s saw Knee-High settle upon a steady annual output of work. They'd make a small indoor show for art centres and village halls to tour throughout the winter, then a big summer show, which would visit the grounds of stately homes, village greens, festivals, and the Minac, Cornwall's theatre carved into the cliff. As well as this, they'd run school workshops, bonfire events, and large community projects. They undoubtedly became recognised as a truly Cornish company. The work was inventive and anarchic. It was accessible and affordable. They consisted of a regular pool of local artists who became known as the Knee-High family. On the theme of regularity, they developed an impressive amount of trust with their audience, who would come back year after year, no matter what the weather or what the show was. There was one person who I think could be described as a mega fan. She became well known for appearing at multiple performances throughout the season and rushing on stage at the end, handing out flowers to the cast. I went to visit her. Her name is Carol Ward.
You said to me once that Knee-High changed your life.
They have, in lots of ways, yeah.
In which way?
The thing is, they were totally transforming. Knee-High was unique. I started following them.
Yeah, and I've heard stories about you, like, throwing flowers on the stage.
Oh, yeah. It is.
Did you used to go on the stage and give them all flowers?
Yeah. Roses. I used to mostly give them roses.
Really? Do you do that with everyone? Or?
Some were exceptional. I would say Peer Gynt was my highlight.
She made the point of Peer Gynt being her favourite show several more times as Carol gave me a tour of her house.
I loved Peer Gynt. I saw it 9 times. I saw it on the green in Newlyn, on the island in St Ives, so Trelawarren, Trelissick.
You followed it around?
Followed it round, and the last performance was up at Restormal.
What really struck me about Carol was her sense of loyalty and absolute love for this company, particularly during the 90s, which some people might say was their golden period. There's a 1996 promotional documentary about Knee-High called Firing the Imagination. It was made by 3S Films. We had the VHS when I was growing up. Within it, some of the company members express their ethos and politics. Here's a young Mike Shepherd.
There are so few companies around nowadays that belong somewhere and are core companies. This company belongs in Cornwall. We're always looking for other influences, whether they come from Tintagel or Cuba, we don't mind, but we're looking to work with other artists, other engineers, other performers, other musicians, to keep that pool of Knee-High aerated and healthy.
As a young artist trying to live and work in Cornwall now, I find a lot of this stuff very inspiring. Here's Sue Hill again, but this time from the 90s.
A lot of actors, particularly working in mainstream theatre in Britain, are hired and fired job by job. You don't have a sense of a developing relationship with the people you're working with or with your directors or your writers. And one of the most wonderful things about Knee-High is it's grown organically, and it's grown as a community and as a family. So there are people who've been working with Knee-High, working together for 15 years.
And then, to summarise everything she's spoken about, Sue says this.
There is one wonderful quote which we kind of keep coming back to. It's a quote by Miro, the painter, Spanish painter. And he said, "If you want to be truly universal, you have to be truly local."
truly local. But what would become of Knee-High? Could they retain the sense of trust they had built with their audience whilst growing and becoming more ambitious? We'll come back to their story a bit later in this episode. But before that, I want to tell you about someone who was sometimes connected to Knee-High, but also very much an artist in his own right. To me, he's a good example of someone whose work remained truly local whilst also being truly universal. It's time to talk about the much-missed Cornish playwright, lobster fisherman, environmental campaigner and parish councillor, Nick Dark. Here's Will Coleman.
Nick Dark was a resolutely Cornish playwright, and one of the real tragedies about him dying is he hadn't finished. He was still on a journey, and he was discovering his own Cornishness and was getting more and more strident about it.
Nicholas Templey Watson Dark was born in the parish of St Evel on the Cornish north coast in 1948. As a young man, he worked as an actor, mainly at the Victoria Theatre in Stoke-on-Trent. But he gave this up in 1978 when he became a full-time writer.
He was a very clever person who cared passionately about equality. Everything he wrote was about trying to promote that. Part of the reason for that was because he grew up in a poor rural community.
In 1990, he moved back to the family home with his wife Jane and their two sons, Jim and Henry. By this time, Nick's work had been performed at the RSC and the National Theatre, but it was following his return to Cornwall that the regular collaboration with Knee-High began. Here's Jane Dark to explain more.
And we lived up the road then, and we had Sue, Anna and Mike come to the kitchen to meet Nick, and they wanted to do Ting Tang Mine, and so they did, and they did it brilliantly. And
do you think Nick enjoyed that?
He absolutely loved it. He loved it. He wrote with certain actors in mind, and he did the same with the King of Prussia. He knew who was going to play those parts he wrote. And that is an ideal. Now, that's how Shakespeare wrote. If you know who's playing the parts, you know what they can do, what their range is, how they can deliver them. Mm. And so it was heaven.
But what was Nick Dark's work actually like? His plays were funny, rude, and featured thick, fast-paced Cornish dialogue. Often, they were period pieces set in Cornwall looking at political, class and social issues that easily mirror what's happening today. The King of Prussia, an 18th century smuggling drama, was actually looking at second homes and the relationship between rich English people and the Cornish working class locals. He often tackled similar themes of rural identity, gentrification, tourism and ultimately, capitalism. He wrote about what he knew and what he saw happening to the place where he was from. Here's a sample of his writing that you can really get your teeth into. It's an extract from Postcards, a commission he had for the BBC, performed especially for this podcast by Mary Woodvine and Beck Appleby. It strangely reminds me of someone we met in episode one.
Are your lobsters still free?
We haven't released them into the wild.
I'll take them both.
Both?
Live, not boiled. Our guest is paying.
That's Andy.
And cooking. A Moroccan.
Oh, well, he can afford it. We don't make no money out of you lot, you know. You might think you spend a fortune.
Goodness me, I do.
Where do it go?
Well...
Don't stay in Cornwall, mate, that's for sure.
I wouldn't say...
How much do you dab out for that place?
What, ocean breezes?
Second week in June, £6.50 a week?
Yes, that's... Well,
where do you send the cheque to? Some party in Surrey?
Matter of fact, yes.
How much of that 650 they're going to spend in Cornwall?
But who knows?
I do. None of it.
It's up to her.
She never set foot in this place. She lives in Surrey. Surrey's going to get it. And where do you go shopping when you're down here, eh? I can tell you, mate, because you've got the bag there.
That's for the lobsters.
Supermarket. Where did that money go? Straight back up the A30. They'll sweeten you up with a cricket pitch to get planning permission and then drain every penny out of the county like blood.
With respect...
If you think the tourist trade's doing any good for we down here, ask yourself why Cornwall's one of the poorest regions in Europe. Why's this district, which is choked up with trippers for 6 weeks of the year, got the highest level of unemployment anywhere in Britain, bar the Mersey? And the lowest wages, eh? Ask yourself that.
Look, I've been coming here for 20 years.
How many weeks is that?
I love Cornwall.
No, you don't.
I beg your pardon.
How can you love someone you've only ever seen for a fortnight?
Don't try it again.
You love your wife?
Of course I love my wife.
Because you know her. You understand her. You're intimate with her.
Look.
That's what love is, Captain. You don't love this place. You love what it do to you. Like a massage, and that's way down the echelon because 'tis self-gratification.
I would advise you to keep these opinions to yourself.
I've kept quiet for 12 years, mister.
Where would you be without us?
Now I'm speaking out.
Eh? I'd like to know that.
Down under, mate.
Exactly.
Although I never met the man myself, even though my dad worked with him and they wrote all these songs together, in a funny sort of way, I've continuously felt the presence of Nick Dark whilst making this podcast. Maybe it's because I've been digging up the same topics and asking similar questions. But it's not just his plays that I find influential. It's more about his lifestyle. I can't recommend enough watching the two documentaries that Jane and Nick made together before he died, The Wrecking Season and The Art of Catching Lobsters. Throughout them, you can see how Nick was truly part of the community. He seemed to know everyone. Everyone knew him. He understood the landscape, the tides, the sea, the weather. At one point, during the second film, which looks at Nick's battle with cancer and Jane's experiences of grief, she talks about how he wasn't a particularly religious man, but he did have a strong sense of place. This massively resonated with me. It's a hard thing to describe, but I too feel a distinct sense of place.
Passionate about Cornwall.
But he also articulated all
he was completely problems. Passionate yeah. And he was very good at articulating, and I think it is a huge loss that he's not here to write about what's going on now. I think it would be very good if there was somebody doing that in a way that he did, because he could look at both sides of an argument, draw you in, make you feel safe from both sides, and then suddenly you were put in the position of looking at the other viewpoint.
That, and it was also quite funny.
And it was funny.
You know, that's an entertaining...
Yeah.
Nick died in 2005. His plays are still performed regularly. I can't help but wonder what he'd think of Cornwall now and the way it's changed. So, what happened to Knee-High Theatre? By the year 2000, the company had found themselves travelling further afield to Europe and South Africa. The director and designer Bill Mitchell had been developing his own style of outdoor site-specific work, which he called landscape theatre. As well as this, Knee-High had just performed Nick Dark's new play, The Riot, at the National Theatre. But things were about to change. All thanks to one mightily ambitious young woman.
Well, I'd been working with a company called Theatre Alibi in Exeter, so I was already in the southwest. I'd moved out of London. We'd been to Poland as a company. I'd been to Poland as a performer. And I was just like bursting with ideas and energy. And there wasn't a full-time job there.
This is the theatre director, Emma Rice. Now, we need to rewind a bit to the mid-90s, when Emma travelled to Cornwall for an audition with this mythical company.
I got picked up by Beck Appleby in the Knee-High van. I remember sort of having these amazing legs that went on forever and bright red lipstick, and then driving from St Austell Station to the Barnes and thinking, where am I? You know, feeling like I'd driven to the end of the planet. But I loved it. I absolutely loved it. You know, I think... I knew it. It was like falling in love. And knowing that we didn't know each other yet, but I honestly felt this is where I need to be, this is where I want to be.
For a few years, Emma worked as an actor within the company. But soon, she had the desire to direct a show of her own. She told me how, particularly back then, it's surprising that it was two men, Bill Mitchell and Mike Shepherd, who gave her the final push she needed.
The Red Shoes was the iconic show for everybody, but not least me, because, you know, I think it was when I felt like a director and saw my work through a prism of confidence and ambition. I feel everything changed then.
The following year, Emma won Best Director at the Barclays Theatre Awards for The Red Shoes. This show picked up press attention as it toured nationally and internationally.
I look back and I just think I was on fire. Everything in my life come together, all the skills that I'd built, all the experiences I'd had. I was in my early 30s. I'd chosen directing. I was just exploding with ideas and a need to tell them.
She went on to direct a string of hit shows, which were often designed for and co-produced with Metropolitan Theatres.
There was one moment when I think we were at Ponsonooth Village Hall, West Yorkshire Playhouse and Broadway. I mean, I think there was a moment when Knee High was spanning the planet.
Emma Rice and Knee High's reputation grew and grew. Their shows were endlessly remounted and toured throughout the world with different casts. They were studied on the GCSE drama syllabus and became recognised as a unique Cornish company. But with success like this, it's also undeniable that some places and people get left behind in the process. Here's Mike Shepherd again.
I think it's really interesting, as a young woman, how much flack Emma Rice took in Cornwall whilst being celebrated everywhere else.
And that's maybe because she took Knee High away from Cornwall? Do you think that's what their argument is?
I think it's certainly true, and it's something Sue Hill said recently, is, and it's not that we lost our audience in Cornwall.
Knee High absolutely let that go. I said that to Mike. I said, you've let it go.
We let them go. But this is where I'm going to say something quite contentious. Mm. None of us earned a fucking living until Emma Rice came.
Mm.
None of us earn a living. So if we're all happy, and this comes back to Cornwall and self-esteem, if we're all happy on 150, 160 quid a week and we can't really do anything.
Yeah.
And that's where, wow, did it boost the coffers, her shows.
But with the boosted coffers came changes. Knee High stopped playing the venues they once had. You could argue they lost touch of the rural communities they'd once been so connected to. Now, instead of seeing them in your local village hall, you had to pay 25 quid to see them at the Hall for Cornwall or their specially built tent, the Asylum. Here's their number one fan again, Carol Ward.
I would say I never missed a Knee High show until I went to Hall for Cornwall and saw, is it Rapunzel, where she lets her hair down?
Yeah.
That was the beginning of the end.
Rapunzel.
That was nothing to do with Knee High. I always said...
But Mike Shepherd was in it, wasn't he?
Mike Shepherd, Emma Rice and jobbing actors is how I put it after that. I left at the interval.
Mm. Do you think
Carol Ward left at the interval?
It seems to me that not only is this a debate about success and ambition, it's also about change and how things inevitably always move on.
Okay, she took things in an interesting direction. Then. It wasn't Knee High anymore.
But do you think that is a natural progression? Like, the thing that you fell in love with, could that have sustained itself and carried on forever?
No, because it was the people, it was the group. She destroyed Knee High.
I asked Emma about this.
I think there was a feeling that I was ruining something and that we were too big for Cornwall. And that was said to me in the street. I would say Mike got the most of it because he was the public face of it. And, you know, my answer was always the same, which is, you know, Cornwall needed to let Knee High grow up. And Cornwall also needs to let the next generation come through. And the next generation needs to push their way in. You know, I mean, that's what I really wanted to say, is Cornwall needed to let us go and pay our bills and possibly get a house that we might live in a little bit. And that's what I wanted to say, is I loved it too. It's really special, but let us go.
Emma Rice's career has gone from strength to strength. She left Knee High to run Shakespeare's Globe, which didn't turn out too well. But she now runs her own company, Wise Children, and recently directed an adaptation of Wuthering Heights at the National. In 2021, for multiple complicated reasons, Knee High finally came to a close. The shows had become large scale, expensive, and infrequent. The world around it and the people within it had changed. Mike Shepherd, however, is already planning his next venture. And Carol Ward can still be seen visiting the Minack Theatre several times a week. The venue recently awarded her a lifetime membership to recognise her dedication to being a loyal audience member. So, it's early spring 2022, and this is the last few minutes of The Reason Why. I'm walking up to the top of Cambrai, and for those of you who don't know, Cambrai is like a big, heathery, gorsy hill that rises like the wild central spine of Cornwall. And it's an amazing view up here. I'm looking out over the housing estates of Redruth and Camborne, and then I can see over to Carbis Bay and St Ives. And on a clear day like today, you can actually see all the way to the other side of Cornwall, over to Penzance and Mounts Bay. I've come up here to think about how to end this series. This is the moment you've all been waiting for and the one I have been dreading, where I look back at all the things I've learnt along the way and try and summarise them into a compact, profound closing statement. But to be honest, I don't think I can do that. A whole year has gone by since I started driving around collecting interviews. And it feels in one way like I have had some closure. I've gone full circle. But I do also still have a lot of unanswered questions. And all of these go round and round my head. And there's simply no, you know, one answer for all of them. But the one thing I will say is that I've definitely come away... That was weird. But yeah, it's clear... What the fuck? Something very strange has just happened where a massive gust of wind has passed me by.
Seamus.
You're not going to believe this, but the sky is changing colour. It's like the Northern Lights, but in the middle of the day.
Seamus.
Who's there?
It is me.
Yeah, who's me?
Don't you know?
No, I don't, and please stop dicking me around.
I am the spirit of Cornwall.
The spirit of what?
The spirit of Cornwall.
Oh yeah? Why can't I see you then?
Because I am the earth, the wind, the water. I am the very essence of this place. The thing so many people try to describe, but fail.
Are you now? Well, how come I recognise your voice?
Do you not know?
Yeah. Hang on a minute. I do now come to think of it. You're the voice that does the intros and the outros of my podcast.
That's right. I am many things.
But I thought you were just someone that Paul the producer put in during the final edit.
Oh no, Seamus. I am the spirit of Cornwall. I've been with you all this time, watching and listening.
This is ridiculous. If you really are the spirit of Cornwall, prove it to me.
Very well.
Fuck. Okay, I believe you now.
Listen, Seamus. I've come to help you.
Help me with what?
You are confused. You are conflicted.
Yeah, I am, actually.
I have come to tell you all shall be well. You are on the right path.
Well, that's easy for you to say, isn't it? But if you really are the spirit of Cornwall, I've got some questions for you.
I will answer what I can, but my time is limited.
Okay, so
Even though I've been trying my hardest to make something good happen in this place, why do people like Dick Penberthy still try to bring me down, going on about how it's not proper Cornish culture?
Oh, Seamus, you will always have haters. You know that. You must remember that culture is a human concept. There are no rules for what is and isn't Cornish culture. But as Will Coleman said,
I don't care whether you think it's contrived. What matters is whether it's good.
Yeah, but I do think there is something unique about Cornwall which shapes the culture. What was it Ollie Berry said?
A strangeness in the landscape, a slightly other quality about the thinking.
That's it. And I do sometimes worry that there's a danger of that distinctiveness being lost.
Lost? How?
Well, by people like Roger coming down, completely oblivious to what exists here already, and turning it into like a beige, homogenised extension of England.
Ah, Roger.
There's not much in the way of life, I don't think, that I have seen that is any different, really, to huge swathes of sort of southern England.
With him, you must think deeper about how his mindset came to be. Remember, he is not breaking the law. That is the way your society is structured. Individualistic capital gain. If anything, he is encouraged to aspire to that position of wealth.
Yeah, that is true. And I am still flummoxed at how Cornwall as a majority voted Tory for the past three general elections. But I do still think Roger could maybe question his morals and whether he's being a bit greedy owning a second home when others can't afford a first. Like Dan from Acorn said.
This home that you own, do you feel like it's beneficial to the community that it's in? And if it's not, then why not?
Yes, but this is where it gets tricky, isn't it? Would you only say that to a rich white person? Who is allowed to come here? How do you police that? And as you questioned, how welcoming is the Cornish community really? Remember what your friend Chloe said.
I should mention one of the reasons I actually moved to Leeds was because I got to a point where I just felt I couldn't deal with the lack of diversity in Cornwall anymore.
Or Emma Frankland.
I've just been shouted at in the street and looked at in the street, and like particularly Falmouth late at night feels not safe.
Yeah, this is a good point. And that's why I want Cornwall to be a more progressive and open-minded place. I'd go with what Andy Rowe said about Cornish identity.
How do you know if you're Cornish? And some dickhead will write in there, you have to have, your mother and father has to be Cornish and you have to have been born in Cornwall. And you think, well, hold on, bud, if we carry on like that, in three generations' time, we aren't going to have any Cornish people. So I think we need to be a bit more welcoming on that front if Cornish identity and culture is to continue.
You must remember, Seamus, that I am but a finger of granite, gorse and sand, jutting out into the Atlantic Ocean. People will come and claim the land as theirs. They'll start traditions, invent culture, keep people out and invite others in. But eventually, they will die and all will be forgotten, including your podcast. The only constant thing is change. Embrace it while you can.
This is deep stuff. I think I know what you mean. But what can I do?
Remember, Seamus, you are not a politician. You are an artist. You have endeavoured to make an honest, nuanced, and thought-provoking piece of work.
Oh, thanks very much. I might use that quote if you don't mind.
Please, don't be trivial during a spiritual visitation such as this.
Sorry.
All you can do is be welcoming, positive, and lead by example. Celebrate the past and embrace the future. To be truly universal, you must be truly local.
Wow. Thanks, Spirit of Cornwall. That's actually made me feel a lot better about stuff.
Now I must go. Someone else is having an existential crisis on St. Agnes Beacon. Goodbye, Seamus.
Goodbye, Spirit of Cornwall. Goodbye. Oh, actually, wait, hang on. There's one more thing I need to ask you.
Quickly, I'm fading.
Okay, so you know the end bit of that song Trelawney? What is the reason why?
The reason why?
Yeah, the reason why.
Well, the reason why is referring to Sir John Trelawney.
Hang on, wait, you're fading, I can't hear you. Wait, Spirit of Cornwall, come back. I didn't hear you say the reason why. Cornwall! What's the reason why?
The Reason Why was written, presented and produced by me, Seamus Carey. I also did the music. The Spirit of Cornwall was played by Jenny Bear. This episode featured music by my dad, Jim Carey. Additional production on the theme tune was by Mr. BJ Jackson. Graphic design by Phila de Blumel. Photography, Steve Tanner. Special thanks to all our contributors throughout this series, particularly those who annoyingly didn't make the edit. I appreciate all of you for your time and generosity. Gratitude as ever to the Holman Climax Male Voice Choir for the sampling of their 1974 album, The Reason Why. The associate producer was Charlie Bunker. The executive producer was Paul Dodgson. This was an Impossible Producing and Seamus Carey production, funded by Arts Council England. Because of that, this podcast will remain free and available for all. But there's one thing I'd like to ask of you. Please shout about it as much as you can. I'd love this passion project to get into as many ears as possible, to provoke, spark the debate, and keep the conversations going. Also, let us know what you thought. Whether good or bad, we'd love to hear from you. Until next time, thanks for listening to The Reason Why.